Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
Back Issue Spotlight number 100, I'm joined by James and Sam, and we're going to be discussing Crisis on Infinite Earths, but only the first four issues, because there's a lot going on there. This was published back in 1985, and the DC Universe was never the same again. James, how you doing tonight?
I am fantastic. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Sam, how about you?
I am very well, gentlemen. Thank you, and hopefully you're doing well as well.
Yeah. Now, I read the Absolute Edition, the heavy tome that it is. Sam, which version did you read?
I have the Absolute Edition, but I did most of my reading and I'm looking today at the issues on the DC Infinite app.
Okay, cool. James, how about you?
I read the Deluxe Edition. So mine's on newsprints, which is kind of nice. I guess I didn't have to recolor it. It comes out more like the comics back in the day. But I really liked it. They had a lot of extra material here at the end, which was kind of cool.
I think that's the big difference between the almost infinite number of ways they've collected this, is the extra material.
Oh yeah, tons of it.
Because I got the omnibus, or the absolute, slipcase, there's a whole, second volume on it. They did the original trade, they did a hardcover, they did 30th anniversary, 35th anniversary, or maybe a 15th and a 20th, I don't know. Plenty of versions.
And on the app, there's kind of two options. There's the, hey, here's the 12-issue series. And then here's the full storyline, which has, all kinds of All-Star Squadron issues, Infinity Inc. issues, Justice League issues, Batman issues, Detective issues, Wonder Woman issues, et cetera, et cetera. And it kind of puts them in an order to read, and it turns out to be, it looks like 58 issues, if you do it that way.
If anything, that seems a little light. But I guess those are the tie-ins, not the lead-ins, necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
Because when this was coming out, there were a couple of things for about the year prior that kind of hinted at it with, the Monitor showing up, and it looked like he was just like a power broker and an arms dealer, giving some people some weapons or giving them some information or whatever, and really cryptic. You never really saw much. And then as it got into Crisis, they had what were kind of dubbed the Red Sky crossovers, where things were starting to happen in Crisis, and other titles, the sky would go red because, multiversal shenanigans are going on, and people were like, oh, what's going on, sort of things. And sometimes it would be like a panel, sometimes it would be a lot bigger aspect of the issue. And then there were others that, and particularly All-Star Squadron, where Earth 2 was fundamentally changed by Crisis, Green Lantern that had a lot of stuff going on at the time, titles like that and a few others, major plot points of the greater Crisis meta story, or whatever you want to call it, happened in those other comics.
And I'm not privy to any of those because I'd never read them. I wasn't reading DC back in 1985, so I was questioning a lot of what is this Red Sky stuff that they keep mentioning.
Yeah, I think this is one of those things where they really had to walk the line between writing this for those kind of in the know that knew the backstory and were trying to make sense of it all, and those that were new, and keeping it accessible, which, given the insane number of characters in these things, is, a feat in and of itself.
Yeah.
But then to be reading this 37 years after the fact, 36 years after the fact, it's not just, are you familiar with DC, but are you familiar with the DC of the time?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot different there. And yeah, I wasn't reading it, so it's kind of jarring to go back and just seeing how many characters there were and how much stuff was going on. I felt like I was being thrown in the deep end right off the bat, but I think it was done for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
As a new reader.
I think the two of us are going to have very different views on this, because for you, again, being thrown in the deep end and stuff, for me, I had been reading DC off the rack for many, many years at that point. Didn't know all of the characters, but I knew a lot of them, and I was excited to learn about the new ones and such. And this is kind of my sweet spot for the DC Universe.
Yeah, so you really loved it because you got to see pretty much everyone that you were enjoying.
Well, yeah, and rereading the first four issues this time around, I get to see some characters I really hadn't seen in decades.
Yeah, yeah. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, and not only is it one of my favorite eras of the DC Universe, but, you know, Marv Wolfman and George Perez as the creative team, you can't get any better than that for the most part.
Yeah, that's an amazing creative team, and the art in here was fantastic. Perez has, like, a certain way. He does, like, almost those shock and awe faces that are just so him than when I see his art in comics, you know, with the people with the look shock as they're seeing what's going on in the universe. It's kind of cool. I mean, just the detail he puts into his work, I've always loved it.
Well, and the similarities and the differences, and this will become clear in some of the later issues, when, like, we get the Earth 1 and Earth 2 Superman, you know, side by side or whatever.
Yeah.
You see the similarities and you see the differences.
Very much so.
And I don't know if any of you guys noticed, I didn't feel it reading it, but I just happened to catch it in the byline. Issue 4 is the first issue that George Perez is not listed as the penciler. He's listed as layouts.
Oh.
Mike DiCarlo is listed as the finisher, whereas in the previous issues, it's penciler inker.
Interesting. I hadn't noticed that.
I hadn't noticed that either.
I'm not surprised, because this first issue was a full 32 pages. The others were, I think, 25 each for the other of the first four. But then in the next group of four, we get another double-sized issue. I think it was 7.
Yep.
And then 12 extra length or whatever. So there was just not only a lot going on, but man, the page count on this thing was intense.
It was massive, and there was a lot of text. With every page, there was a lot going on. I mean, that's a sign of the times. I mean, the stories weren't really decompressed then. They were more condensed.
You know, it's funny, because I was thinking about that this evening, and 12 issues plus another 2 or 3 because of the extra-sized length of some of the issues. We'll be generous and say it's 15 of today's 20-page... Actually, it's more than that, because some of these were 25 pages. I don't know how many of today's comics it would work out to be page-wise, but I don't know that the new 52 runs of titles that lasted 52 issues of 20 pages each, if any one of those would have had, given that storytelling style, the space to tell this story, because so much happens here.
So much happens. It's almost kind of jarring going back in time, but I mean, you get used to it after you read it for a little while, but just so much is going on that you almost, from time to time, I'd be like, in a modern day comic, you can almost breeze past a page, you know, talking heads, and you kind of read, okay, I get the gist of it, and skip over if you wanted to, if you're not enjoying it. With this, you can't do that, because on each page, there could be a lot of stuff that happens just right there, and it may be something that, if you miss it, it's going to affect the story, so you have to dig in and read all this stuff. It's a little bit time-consuming, but you got your money's worth, and this stuff was way cheaper back then.
Yeah, yeah. And this took me most of an evening to read through the four issues, and I was taking notes and stuff, so that slowed me down. And every once in a while, it's like, hey, wait a sec, I need to go check something, so you know, I'll go hit Wikipedia or somewhere else on the internet just to, you know, which version of Killer Frost with this, and some stuff like that that I was just curious about. Doesn't impact the story, but, you know, hey, inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah. Oh, and full disclosure, I appreciate your help because, Sam, you didn't know this, but I messaged John and I'm like, we were just chit-chatting about something on Slack. And I was like, man, I'm struggling with, I don't know who these characters are, and it's taken me forever to try and look them up. And he's like, just enjoy the story and don't worry about who's who. Because once I did that, the story got better. Because trying to figure out who's who, it's confusing.
Well, I am more of a DC aficionado than you seem to be, James. I'm nowhere near John's level, and I didn't really start until kind of just after Crisis.
Oh, okay.
So I've gone back and read a lot of it, but again, only kind of the main characters. I've gone back and read Superman and Flash and, you know, the ones we know.
Yeah.
But you take a look at that collection that ends up on the satellite in the end of this first issue and in the second issue. Firebrand, I have no idea who that is. Geoforce, completely unfamiliar with. Arion, no idea. Dr. Polaris, no idea. And you know, that's a third of this group, a quarter of this group, something like that. And yeah, I kind of quickly wikied some of them, but I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go with it and learn whatever they have to tell me.
Well, yeah, I think you've got to treat this kind of like a World War II movie or something like that, where you're there for the historic event. You're not there to get to know everything about every character.
Yeah.
And if you look at the wraparound cover of the first issue, where they've got all the worlds blowing up, and they've got essentially those 15 characters plus a few others that are in that group at the end, some of these characters had never actually shown up in a DC comic before, like Blue Beetle.
Oh.
Some of these were never seen in a DC comic after this, or at least not these versions of them.
Like Alexander Luther, I'm not sure was anywhere before this, was he? I mean, the father, not...
The father absolutely was.
Was he?
He was the lone hero of Earth 3. He showed up in a couple of DC Comics Presents annuals, okay. And not that he'd been seen that often, but he had been seen before.
Okay, fair enough.
So this was Blue Beetle's first appearance.
In DC.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
He was one of the many characters from other publishers that they kind of pulled in.
Gotcha, okay, makes sense.
Arion had a 35-issue series where he was the, you know, Wizard of Atlantis. It was a period piece, you know, fantasy series set in the past before Atlantis fell. Dr. Polaris was a Green Lantern villain. Geo-Force was one of the main players in Batman and the Outsiders. So there's a couple, yeah, if you didn't read particular titles, you don't know. You know, Firebrand was one of the major characters in All-Star Squadron, a title that I loved. So where you guys are like, who are they? And which is a fair question, because, again, either you know or you don't. And it's very easy, particularly 36 years after the fact, to not know. Again, I was like, man, I love seeing these characters again.
Yeah. And another example, Simeon, I know, but all of that is because of the rereads you and I have done, John, of the early New Teen Titans. If it hadn't been for those rereads, I don't know if I would have recognized him either.
Salivar, actually.
No, not the psychic guy with like the...
Oh, Simon.
Simon,
yeah.
Simeon,
yeah,
however right. He pronounces it, okay.
I pronounce it Simon, I'm not going to say I'm right.
Yep, fair enough.
Yeah, he's one that did not show up much after this. I was going to say, if at all, it's really hard to say that because some of the characters that show up later may have the same name, but I would argue are not the same character.
Yeah.
The Ultraman we get here in this crime syndicate, I don't consider to be the same crime syndicate that just had a 6-issue limited series in the modern DC stuff. I mean, they're clearly based on the original group here, but yeah. But yeah, there's
a lot.
A lot, and it can be definitely overwhelming. And if you're trying to go in thinking you need to know all this stuff, again, I think that's the wrong approach to take.
Yeah.
You know, enjoy what you can. If you pick up the Easter eggs, great. But it'd be like seeing Who Framed Roger Rabbit and thinking you had to have seen every cartoon that was ever produced before to enjoy it. You don't.
Exactly. Yeah, once I got rid of that, and I just kind of like, oh, I remember that guy. I even forget their names most of the time when I'm going through it. But I was able to enjoy it for what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And where it's headed, where the story's going.
Well, the tagline for this was, worlds will live, worlds will die, and nothing will ever be the same again, or something to that effect. And I think they lived up to that.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, one other thing I want to say is thanks to Marv Wolfman for doing that intro, which I know is in all the versions, because it was really kind of cool hearing him say what his reasoning was behind doing this, and why he did this, why he did that, and how comics were back then, you know? A miniseries had never been a thing, you know, and people don't even jump onto comics until it's been out for at least 6 issues. It's just hilarious to read that.
Yeah, times have definitely changed.
Nobody buys a number one. Those times, yeah, that was hilarious.
I remember when Superman Presents the Krypton Chronicles, I think it was published. It was a 3-issue miniseries, and they had to kind of explain that on the cover of 1 of 3, you know? 4 months from now, it's going to be gone kind of implication, because again, it just wasn't done.
It's funny.
Yeah, now it's hard to get a week's worth of comics and not get a number one.
It's true. I think I get a number one with almost everything that comes out. It's insane.
Yeah. Now, in this first issue, they cover everything from the origin of the multiverse, introducing a couple of new characters, blowing away a long-standing reality of the DC multiverse. And it just keeps going from there. I mean, that's just in the first couple of pages.
Yeah, you see things going on. You see Flash stuff happening with him. I mean, it was just complete insanity. Because when I'm going in here, I'm like, who are these characters? What's going on? Why is everyone dying? You're just like, what in the heck's going on? So the mystery's there, and you want to know why. And then you start realizing, okay, we're getting a band together type thing. We're getting these heroes drawn from all over the multiverse, assembled by, and we get introduced to the Monitor at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and really, I think, unless I'm wrong, I'm assuming this is where Harbinger starts, John. So this is kind of, we're introduced to her, who's really doing the assembling for the second half of this issue?
Yeah, it's remotely possible she had been seen in something like a week or so before, but I'm pretty sure this is chronologically her first appearance. Whether there was something that jumped the gun or not, I don't recall. But yeah, and Monitor and Lila had been seen, you know, in the shadows or obliquely or something like that in some of the lead up things. But this was their proper introduction.
And as you pointed out, Blue Beetle was new to the universe at this point as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first issue was cool because the stakes are set. It's really high. You see the things being destroyed. You see everyone getting together. And then the Monitor's like, I've summoned you here because your universes are about to die. So that's a heck of a first issue.
Yeah. Well, and there are a couple of things they did just throughout it that I thought were fun little Easter eggs and whatnot. Just seeing them kill off Earth 3, so showing, hey, we're not kidding. We are going to change some stuff. But then seeing Lex and Lois rocket their son off to a world to save him, very much intentional strong parallels to Superman's origin.
Yeah, I found that funny.
Well, and it's not the only place we get some of those parallels to a famous origin. It was, I think, the most obvious, but it was fun. And just seeing the Justice League satellite where he lands, and it's like, yep, nobody's home. You know, it's like, oh yeah, that's where things were at this point in continuity.
Now, I have a question for you here now that we've mentioned Earth 3 and it's been destroyed. Was Earth 3 very popular prior to this? Were there books around Earth 3? Did you visit that world or that universe very often?
Okay, for pre-crisis, the metric to use on that, so Earth 1 was where almost everything was. The next most common world to ever see was Earth 2. At this point in time, All-Star Squadron was running that was set in World War II of Earth 2, and Infinity Inc. was set in the present day of Earth 2. Other worlds that had their own title, Earth X in the late 70s had the Freedom Fighters. And beyond that, not too many other worlds had gotten their own actual freestanding book. Captain Carrot and the Zoo Crew on Earth C.
John, what about the Shazam we're currently covering? Isn't that Earth S?
Yeah, that was Earth S that was going on at the time. Or actually, again, it had ended a few years prior to this, but yeah, that had gotten its own book. Other worlds that were recurring, but not, you know, having necessarily their own book, Earth 3 falls into that category.
Okay.
They'd shown up a number of times with the Crime Syndicate in the Justice League JLA-JSA crossovers, in a Secret Society of Supervillains, and I'm trying to think a few other places here and there. But it's not like Earth 3 had its own title on a regular basis.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And so you can see where Marv's trying to take this. He's like, you come in as a DC reader, and he had written about that, and let's say I'm enjoying Superman and Batman and The Flash and whatever, the big names, Green Lantern,
mm-hmm.
and then I start getting this stuff. I'm like, what is this Earth 3? I knew there was an Earth 1 or Earth 2, and then it causes confusion, and people are like, okay, now there's all these other Earths, and so he's wanting to clean this up. Let's get rid of this stuff because it hampers new readers coming in.
Well, it's funny because if you look at that first page when they're talking about the origin of the multiverse and what was multiverse that should have been one became many and such, a variation on this page explaining parallel worlds was a frequent thing at the beginning of a JLA-JSA crossover.
Ah.
Because you got to explain, wait, who's the JSA? Why aren't they in the same world as the JLA? What's going on? Why do we have two Flashes? But it got to where that was just almost a muscle memory thing for the writers and artists to kind of put in. As a reader, I never found that stuff confusing.
Okay.
You know, sometimes they needed to be a little clear of, oh, wait, this backup feature of, you know, the Huntress that's in the back of Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman's on Earth 1, Huntress is on Earth 2. Okay, got it.
Cool.
The full explanation there, but, you know, that kind of thing suffices. And there were a couple of titles, Brave and the Bold's an example of that, where sometimes they kind of blurred the lines, and yeah, they're an Earth 2 character, they're teaming up with the Earth 1 Batman, there's no moving from Earth to Earth, it just is an adventure and it's fun.
Okay. And so this first chapter played out almost like when Bendis destroyed the Ultimate Universe, and pretty much the only character that came over that's kind of a note is Miles Morales into the main 616. And here we got Lex and Lois's son.
Yeah, although it takes a few issues for him to really kind of become a meaningful character.
Correct. Yeah, he comes over as a baby.
We keep saying Lex. Everywhere in here, his father's referred to as Alexander, like him.
Oh, yeah.
Is
Alexander,
that?
Yeah.
It is Alexander, okay. Yeah.
Fair enough. Just wanted to make sure I wasn't misreading something.
No.
Nope.
Just me, shorthand.
And the other thing I find kind of interesting in this issue is the whole, what Psycho Pirate does to Killer Frost. Well, I'm not familiar with this Killer Frost. Clearly, she's an enemy of Firestorm's normally.
Yes.
And that kind of then changes this relationship, at least through this story.
Yeah.
She is the second Killer Frost who willingly became Killer Frost to get the power to kind of strike back against Firestorm for the death of the previous Killer Frost. Not that he was responsible, but you know how villains are. And with a name like Killer Frost, you can imagine how friendly she normally is.
And I think that added some comedy to the book. It was nice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's funny because at one point in one of the later issues, he's commenting on how he would have much rather been teamed up with one of his other villains of Firehawk or Black Bison. And I find that funny because Firehawk was more in the misunderstood than evil category and wound up being a longtime ally of Firestorm.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. What I loved about this first issue is we get to see some just iconic pre-crisis locations. Gorilla City, the Legion of Superheroes time frame. We go to World War II on Earth 2. We see a little bit of Arion's place of Atlantis, 45,000 years ago and such. So just throughout this series, we get to see kind of what I would consider the major spots if you were to do a quick tour of the DC universe of the time.
Yeah, which was kind of nice. I didn't know who a lot of them were, but I kind of, figured it out as I read it and went along with it, but at the beginning, I was like, what in the heck is going on? It's a lot of them, but it starts making sense the more and more I read it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like how they take the approach of a lot of these characters don't know each other, because they've either never met, or in some cases, they're offset by decades.
True.
So I think that was some of the stuff they did to keep it reasonably accessible. But again, if you go in thinking, I got to know everything about everybody, yeah.
That's a lesson in frustration.
Well, and again, when I was reading this originally, there were a couple of these characters that I was not all that familiar with. I mean, I don't think I'd seen much of Dr. Polaris. I'm trying to think if I'd read the Arion series at this point or picked it up later as back issues. But again, there's just so much DC history at this point, 50 years in, you couldn't, in most cases, know it all.
Yeah, and these are characters that we still don't visit today. In the current DCU, we just don't see these characters very much. Blue Beetle, I mean, Superman, but this is a different version of Superman.
It's a different Superman. More often than not these days when we see Blue Beetle, it's often the younger, newer version than the Ted Kord version, although we're seeing more of him lately. And then again, Simon and a few of the others we just haven't seen in ages. So yeah, it's fun to see them again, and I do think that for newer readers, it does make it a little harder to kind of get into the story.
I agree.
Move on to the second issue?
Yeah, let's do that.
At this point, the Monitor has gathered his forces, and stuff, I don't say starts to happen. A lot already happened in the first issue. But this is where it's funny, because we've got the hand-picked crew of the Monitor, and I gotta say, I had some questions of, okay, why recruit these heroes and villains?
That's what I was thinking. It's just a motley crew of, like, who are these? Why pick them?
Well, like Dawnstar, she's a tracker. They make a point of mentioning that.
Yes.
Yet in these four issues, doesn't seem to matter any.
Yeah, she's not used really for that purpose.
She mentions it one time later, even though, again, it's not used. I want to say in issue 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. Well, but we've got the handpicked crew of, I don't know why they were handpicked, but they're there. And then we get what I'm going to refer to as the locals. And I'm going to use that term a little loosely because sometimes they're not strictly speaking locals. But like we start with Anthro, the first boy, saving his village from a stampede of woolly mammoths or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so we're getting a juxtaposition of various points that they travel to and the people from there and the people that, you know, travel to them and such. And, you know, we spend a couple of pages there at the beginning with Anthro and stuff. Again, not a character I was particularly familiar with at the time. And I loved how he kind of, you know, bumps his head, sees the city of the future, and then poof, it's gone, along with the woolly mammoths and stuff.
Yeah.
This is setting up the time is a bit out of sorts at this point.
Exactly. So it's not just the worlds or the universes, it's time. Everything is mixed up. Because we're getting World War II, we're getting prehistoric stuff, all kinds of things.
Well, and that's one of the things you got to kind of wrap your mind around. Is there's this antimatter wave that wiped out Earth 3 in the first issue. It's hitting other worlds, but it's hitting it across time. Because on the one hand, you would think, well, if it wipes it out in World War II, there is no after World War II period for it to wipe out. It already got there.
Correct.
But it's hitting, you know, the 30th century at the same time it's hitting, you know, 45,000 years ago in Atlantis and such. So the cross-time aspect is kind of weird.
Yeah. Kind of weird, cool and weird at the same time. Because at first I was like, why are we doing this? What's going on? And I was like, okay, I see what we're doing here. And I just kind of rolled with it. Made it much more enjoyable.
Yeah. And I enjoy seeing this version of the Legion of Superheroes and stuff. It's been many a decade since we'd gotten this group.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. And do you like the Joker in here, too? That version of the Joker?
It's the iconic version, or an iconic version, I suppose I should say.
I agree.
Yeah, I like him. Having read Batman at the time, I don't know that, and maybe it's just my opinion's been colored by all the comics I've read since, this feels ever so slightly anachronistic.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a fun version.
It is. And here's it's issue two where we get the Flash showing up and almost vanishing. And that's with the Joker and the Batman scene, and he almost disintegrates right before Batman's eyes. And he's like, what? He's going, oh, and he literally says, I'm disintegrating before my eyes. As I'm looking at it.
Well, and there's a reference in one of the issues, I think one or two after this, where Batman is still a bit kind of discombobulated by watching that.
Yeah.
And it takes a bit to kind of phase Batman like that.
Correct.
Now, he does mention at one point that Flash had vanished, because at this point, he'd left the 20th century to go live in the 30th century.
Oh, okay, that's why.
Yeah, and we get a little of that in issue 3 or 4, I think, of where he's there and he comes back to the present.
Yeah, because I saw him coming back. All right, cool.
But some of this is, again, just trying to understand where these characters are in their particular timelines and such.
Yeah, and we get another screenshot of our Motley Crue there again.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's nice to get the names to go with them and such.
It is.
Around this time, Who's Who was coming out, so if you needed more information, you could get some of it there. It was interesting that the fates of Earths 1 and 2 were kind of linked, and they were next up, but they at least get to watch, you know, what we'd seen last issue of Earth 3 getting vaporized.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. I like that. And we get that big, almost like Kirby-esque machine when we get to Commandy in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big cosmic tuning forks is kind of what I call those things, because I don't know what else to call them.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I'm like, what is this thing? Oh, that works. Cosmic tuning forks. All right, we'll go with that.
I was going to say, I believe Dr. Light calls them exactly that in issue 4, or something similar.
I know that he refers to as the cosmic doohickeys or something by somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Commandy with the Great Disaster, again, another kind of iconic era and time frame. And I love the way this is described as it is sometime in some future in a timeline that at times stands between the modern Earth and a 30th century which knows nothing of its existence. So this is kind of one of those, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. And just trying to dance around the fact that they've told a ton of stories in The Great Disaster, which in theory is between the 20th century of now and the 30th century of the Legion, yet the Legion knows nothing of this.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of inconsistencies that Crisis was supposed to start to give them the opportunity to fix. For my money, it just made things worse.
Ah, all right. Because it did change it. They're trying to basically get rid of the inconsistency. So the 20th to the 30th, when you have the Legion in the future, it makes sense, because they would have known about this if this happened on Earth-1.
You'd certainly think so, yeah.
Kirby created it, and nobody knows about it. So that makes sense now.
Well, and you got characters that one creative team forgot that they'd teamed up before, so they're introducing them as if they'd met for the first time or something like that. You're going to wind up with inconsistencies unless you've got a really good team of editors and or kind of continuity cops. So it's inevitable for that sort of thing to happen.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird. Like, they didn't just say Kirby's creation happened on a different Earth, you know, Z or whatever. So they didn't have to explain it. So they didn't have to wipe out continuity.
Exactly. They could have just as easily had it been the future of Earth 2 or, again, some other Earth, like you said.
Yeah, yeah. Just a footnote or something instead of messing things up. Just saying, we're destroying it, smashing it all together.
Yeah, yeah. Might have been the better way to go.
Yeah. So this is the first time where we get the shadow creatures popping out of the machine.
Yeah, the shadow demons and such.
We had seen them, though, on the satellite in the previous issue.
At the end of the first issue, you're right. Yeah, they show up to be a nuisance, and then when it's convenient for them to go away, they do.
Yeah, they just run away. All the shadows fly away.
Well, until they all reform.
Yeah, when we get the giant shadow demons a little later and such.
And this issue is also the issue where we get the shocking reveal of this baby from Earth 3 has grown up quite a bit.
Yes, he is aging unusually fast. He's, I don't know, 5 or 6 at this point when we see him at one point. By the next issue, I think he becomes like a teenager or something.
Yeah, he's still unclothed, but he's still laying there naked like a baby, but he's not a baby.
Well, and we see him, I don't remember if it's this issue or next.
It's the next,
a little later.
Where they explain what makes him so unique.
Yeah, yeah. In this, we also see a couple of other characters from Arion's time frame and such, because that's where one of the tuning forks is. We get a little bit more with Psycho Pirate.
Well, I would argue that's important. Because we will never see kind of this villain, the enemy, in these 4 issues. But this is the first time he really kind of appears, sort of, at least speaking to the Psycho Pirate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and speaking to Harbinger.
Yes. And clearly he's extremely powerful with the fact that he can, you know, just make Psycho Pirate's face disappear. And, you know, what exactly his powers are aren't quite clear at this point. Not that they ever really become clear, but...
They're of narrative convenience. Because the whole wiping his face so he can't express emotions and then giving it back, it's like, I don't... Yeah, that was just kind of weird. But we're playing, you know, with cosmic-level beings at this point, with the monitor and anti-monitor.
And also, and I don't know, John, if you remember, the comment about Raven being just gone... Do you remember why that is, or does she show up later? I don't remember if she does.
I know the Titans show up later.
Yep. I don't know if Raven ever does, though.
I'm trying to think of when this was with the Titans book. This was around the time they had Cole, and I don't think Raven was on the team at the time.
Well, here's what's interesting. One of the crossovers listed in kind of the more complete reading order is one of the Titans issues we just covered 13.
No, it's not.
Okay, it's listed here.
It's got the same name. It's a different series.
Well, this is the one with the Doom Patrol. Like I said, it is an issue we just covered.
Are you sure? Because I think there's one that has a Crisis crossover banner that's New Teen Titans issue 13, and Cole and Jericho are members,
That may be correct, and this is just programmed incorrectly?
That would be the case, then, because this takes place, like, 4 years after the issues we've been reading.
Fair enough. Because that issue, you're right, it even says on here, November 1981, you're right, it wouldn't be, yet it's listed here on the list of books in this crossover. Interesting.
Well, again, there was another New Teen Titans number 13 of another volume.
Yeah, so it's the other volumes 13 that fits in here, not this one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the confusing part that annoys me so much when they keep revoluming and reusing titles, is you get to something like that, well, oh, you just need to go read New Teen Titans number 13 and 14. And there's, like, multiple ones to pick from.
Yeah, yeah. It's even confused the DC database, apparently.
Yeah.
I'm just laughing as I hear this stuff.
Well, I had seen a technical presentation that was done about graph databases and stuff and how Marvel uses them to basically keep all their stuff straight behind the scenes for these sorts of reasons. Because you can't just say, oh, you know, it's an appearance of Captain America in Captain America or whatever, because there have been multiple Captain America characters in multiple Captain America titles. And here's a case where, again, they mixed up which volume of the title.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah. I get it, but it's sloppy.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, it was kind of cool. I remember this. Like, I thought it was kind of nice how they didn't tell us through 4 issues anything about the Anti-Monitor. So you get the black character. It's always in black. You can't see him. Just out of view. And he basically turns two of the team members from the Monitor's team to doing his bit.
Well, and the important part of that is when we see Harbinger looking for Arion when she was recruiting him and getting hit by one of the Shadow Demons.
Yep.
In the first issue and stuff. So they do plant the seeds, but there's so much going on, it's easy to miss some stuff.
Yeah.
Because at this point, Anti-Monitor is only referred to as the Other.
The Other. Exactly. My first read through this 5 years ago, I didn't know who the Other was, but now I remember. That's one of the things I do remember, the Anti-Monitor.
Well, and I remember reading it at the time, and yeah, had no clue who the Other was, what was going to happen. I mean, imagine reading this on a month-to-month basis, knowing that they're essentially, you know, doing literally a scorched earth approach to fixing their continuity. You don't know what's on the other side of this.
And I imagine it's exciting. Because you know it's big. You know something big is happening. You're watching it happen. And you're like, oh my gosh, what's the end game? What's the end game? Oh, who is this character? Oh, man. And you're seeing characters you like get affected.
Mm-hmm.
So it's riveting, especially if you're invested in the universe and the characters like you were for years.
Absolutely. And the fact that they had their top creative team of the time on it.
Yeah.
It's not like a modern event where they've done them so many times for so many decades that it's just, oh yeah, another one. This was an unheard of kind of project with unguessable ramifications. And I would be very, very hard pressed to name any other series title story like this that had anywhere remotely near the ramifications this had. Because I think we're still feeling the ramifications of it today in a very, very real sense. You know, every time they swing the pendulum between, oh, we got multiple Earths, to, oh, we got a single Earth, and back.
Yeah, it's all because of this.
I wouldn't say it's because of this, because I think this was in response to problems that they're propagating right now in DC. You know, you've got a Nightwing in his own book, which I'm loving, and a Nightwing in the Titans Academy book that, wait a sec, which city is he living in? How is he commuting? How is this working?
He's flying back and forth every month.
These are the kinds of continuity snafus that this series was kind of trying to give them a clean slate for.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny that they allow it to happen, but I think DC right now is just throwing their hands up and they said, it all happens, it all matters, and what is the thing they're calling it now? Not the Omniverse, they're calling it the something else. I can't remember.
I thought it was the Omniverse.
Is it the Omniverse? I can't remember. But
you can throw new titles at it, but it doesn't matter. If you're not worried about how the stories you're telling today are setting you up for tomorrow, you're doomed to failure.
I agree. I really do agree. And it's almost uncanny how Marvel hasn't gotten into as many of those snafus, whereas DC seems to be in that constant state. But hope for better things. There's another crisis coming, I have a feeling.
Well, it's funny. If we go back to that lineup of the crew that the Monitor had picked out.
Okay.
Of those characters, only one of them, maybe two, possibly three if you're generous, are in frequent use and more or less kind of sort of the same, I was going to say same general state they were in here.
Yeah.
The ones that come to mind are the John Stewart Green Lantern, Cyborg, more recently maybe Obsidian. But beyond that, these characters are either, you know, by today's standards, crazy obscure. You could argue Blue Beetle. But I mean, they've revamped and redone or just tossed aside most of these characters.
Yeah.
The Golden Age Superman, I'm not current enough, but the Golden Age Superman certainly returned in a big way for one of the next crises.
Certainly he did in Infinite Crisis. But then once you get past Final Crisis, once you got past 52, and they've, again, inflated and deflated, are we a multiverse or a universe? You know, even though they've brought back the JSA more recently, there's no sign necessarily of a Superman of that world.
That is true.
I mean, we probably have one given the state of the multiverse, but it's not, again, like he was then. And Cyborg, he's sort of the same character, but his backstory is fundamentally different in a way that the everything matters, everything happened makes worse. Was his origin part of what led up to the Teen Titans, or was it because of the formation of the Justice League?
Yeah, both can't be happening.
Both can't be true, you know?
But yet they're saying it did. Both happened. Both matter. But that doesn't work.
It doesn't. That's the part that frustrates me, and this is part of why I like this era of DC better, is one, we get just so much more story going on here. I mean, we get little character arcs for a lot of these characters and such. Even in, like, the lineup, there's a little going on with, you know, Firestorm and Killer Frost and stuff.
Yeah.
There was a story density here and a feeling that what happened to these characters in one stories mattered across all of the stories that character showed up in. Because it was one version of the character.
Yeah.
Anything else on number two, or should we jump to number three?
That's it for me.
Me too.
All right. Issue number three, we come in and start learning a little bit more what's going on with this young Luthor kid. And beyond aging rapidly and being, it seems like, a teenager at this point, or almost, he's both positive and antimatter, which is impossible. Even in the DC universe, which I find fascinating and makes sense, but, you know. A lot of things I think are impossible are everyday occurrences there.
Still no clothes. Poor kid.
Yeah, well, he makes up for that. I think in one of his next appearances where he's got, you know, armor, it seems like, head to toe.
Yeah.
So, again, what started as a parallel to a Superman origin, obviously going in a bit of different direction here. Although, new powers on the new world, you know, different powers than Superman, but still, parallel is there.
This is where we get the Flash popping back into here. And you're like, what's going on? But no, it's Earth, our future.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they always play a little fast and loose with exactly when in the future he was living, because it was the 30th century, but it was before the time of the Legion of Superheroes, arguably by about two generations, if they keep the timeline straight.
Okay.
Because he had kids, and those kids later, again, this is all post-crisis, of course, became, one of them became a Legionnaire, the other one became Impulse.
Yeah.
And they did, years after this, a one-shot that was part of the Legends of the DC Universe, I think it was. It was kind of an issue 4.5, and they expand a little bit on what was going on with Barry at this time. And really, it's kind of a little bit leading up to the scene, and a little bit kind of after and between the pages and such, just to flush it out a little better, and to go visit another world that, in the course of that one shot, gets destroyed.
Okay.
And it was kind of interesting. It, I don't know if it totally feeds in with the narrative, but yeah, whatever.
It's kind of cool. Now, I did have a question in this issue, but it's a little bit further down the road.
Before we get there, John, I do find the one page dedicated to Brainiac and then him disappearing again kind of unique.
Unique in what sense?
I don't remember when Brainiac comes back, so at this point I'm expecting it. Obviously, I could be completely wrong.
He comes back around, I want to say, issues 8 and 9, maybe?
Okay.
When we kind of get the villains deciding this is the time to get organized and strike.
Okay.
I think, again, I've only reread up through issue 4. The other thing I find unique about this page is that it is a scene contained within a single page.
Yeah.
Yes.
A lot of these scenes, breaks, are happening mid-page, which seems very different than a lot of what we get now. Because now it feels like page breaks and scene breaks align, whereas here they certainly were not.
Yeah. It's also, well, George Perez has 9 panels, or something close to 9 panels on many pages. This is like the only perfect grid like this I can think of in this entire book.
Yeah, well, and it kind of makes sense given the robotic Brainiac we've got here. This is the robot Terminator skull-looking kind of version that came about from, I want to say, Action 544, somewhere in that time, when they kind of redid Brainiac and Luthor for one of the anniversaries or whatever.
Yeah. To Sam's point, though, almost every page in here, the panel layout's completely different from page to page.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and if you look at the page before it, I mean, how many panels are on that page?
So many.
Yeah, I mean, close to 20, I think?
Yeah, they're all over the place. I mean, but I think that's for a purpose. It's almost showing you the chaos and the messiness of what the universe and what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they're getting at. By throwing all this stuff in here, it's confusion, it's messy action, it's destruction. You know, when things go south, when there's a natural disaster, and this is a universe-wide disaster, there's panic sets in, and everything goes to hell in a handbasket. And that's what we're seeing.
Absolutely. I want to go back to page 7 of that issue, a few pages before that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a subtle thing. At this point, the Titans and the Outsiders are in New York. They're trying to save people as buildings are collapsing and everything's kind of going haywire and such. And Halo of the Outsiders goes into an apartment through a window, rescues a girl from under a crib or whatever. This may not seem like much. This is a pretty much a parallel to Wonder Girl's origin, except it was a fire, not a collapsing building, and it was Wonder Woman, not Halo.
Oh.
Which Wonder Girl?
The Donna Troy one,
right
there.
Fair enough. Okay.
If you remember the various Who is Donna Troy, Who is Wonder Girl kind of issues they did in the New Teen Titans.
Mm, okay.
They kind of tell that part of the origin, how she doesn't know who her family was.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So that's tiny little thing. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't. It doesn't matter. But that's the kind of stuff I love about this.
That's cool. And I didn't know that. Thanks for pointing that out.
Well, and Halo is a character that we just haven't seen for ages and was, you know, a longtime member of the Outsiders.
I've never seen her. This is the first time.
She's a ton of fun. Batman and the Outsiders is a title worth checking out, I think. And again, we're getting them and the Titans quite a bit here in the first part of this issue.
Yeah, this is the whole Teen Titan focus right before we get the Brainiac. And then it jumps to World War II with Sergeant Rock.
Yeah. I do want to point out Cole, who's one of the Titans there.
Yeah.
Pretty much created for this series so they could kill her off.
Oh, created just to be killed.
I think so. Pretty sure. But yeah, when we get to 1944 here in Markovia, another of the big cosmic tuning forks and such, this is again where we get the quote-unquote locals, although obviously not from these parts. They're just in for the war. We get Lieutenant Stewart and the Haunted Tank crew. We get Sergeant Rock and Easy Company. We get the Losers. So as many of the World War II era characters as they could cram in here, they did.
Yeah, they were all here. It was kind of cool. I mean, they're here, but I always considered, like, the World War II and even the Western stuff, like Jonah Hex later on, like, just time pieces, not really a separate world, but I guess it's showing it's affecting through time, but it's not something that needs to be explained, I felt like.
It's not something they needed to integrate into the DC universe and stuff, but
yeah.
They felt they could, so why not?
Yeah, I guess they said, that's what you're saying, they could, so that's why I was asking. I don't know why they would bring them in, but just because they can do it.
Well, and they'd already established that, you know, World War II happened on both Earth 1 and Earth 2, and
yep.
At least on Earth 2, when you had the heroes that were active at the time,
right?
Because heroes came later on Earth 1, between the Spear of Destiny and a few other things, the JSA couldn't just go over and fight the war.
Okay.
So that's why you had just standard war stories kind of going on and whatnot.
Okay, cool.
So there are a couple of times they had to do some kind of, you know, narrative gymnastics to explain, yep, we got superheroes. Nope, they're not fighting the good fight where we'd like them to, but here's why.
Here's why. Okay. All right, makes sense.
And certainly when I was reading it, these were not characters I was particularly familiar with, not having read many, if any, of the war comics and such. And one or two of these characters, like Flowers, I'm pretty sure originated in this issue.
Oh, okay. I was a big fan of the Haunted Tank, because I would go to this old shop where they had back issues and G.I. Combat. That's the stuff I would pull out.
Mm-hmm.
I used to love it.
Yeah, no, G.I. Combat and Sergeant Rock and Easy Company were great books, and Losers you'd also get in G.I. Combat.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
I know. Me too. I was so excited when they announced G.I. Combat as one of the new 52 titles originally, and then Superman was in the very first issue, and I went, yeah, okay, it's not going to be the same.
Yeah. No. One of my gripes, I guess it's because there's not enough fans, but this is the stuff that never gets collected.
No, it doesn't.
It's... Well, and I would have been tempted to pull in some of the characters from Weird War Tales of the Creature Commandos, G.I. Robot, and a few of those characters.
Yeah, they could have stuck them all in here, honestly.
Yep.
I mean, there's also the Unknown Soldier. I mean, there's a bunch of other kind of war characters they could have thrown in here.
Yep.
But as it was reasonably crowded.
It was. It was already crowded. A ton of characters.
But it really, over the course of the series, shows the depth and breadth of the DC universe as it was at the time.
Yeah, there was so much there, from Western to war comics to superheroes to obscure superheroes on different planets. It was just massive.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is one of the few places on page 16 there where we've got Dr. Polaris and Geo-Force, Polaris using his magnetic powers, Geo-Force using his gravity powers, if they're doing it in tandem to take out one of these shadow demons.
Yep.
You know, and this is like, oh, now I can see why maybe there was a rhyme or reason to some of these characters.
Now it makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah. One of the few places where that happened.
Yeah. That was pretty cool.
But again, you're here for the spectacle, not for the minutiae necessarily, although there's plenty of cool minutiae and Easter eggs.
Yeah. And that whole scene, the whole war scene, takes place over 3 pages. I mean, that's how crammed in it is. There's so much that happened there.
Well, and we stay in that era for a little bit with Blue Beetle and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it in a modern comic, though, that scene would have been its own issue, I think.
That's what I think. They would have had the war issue, you know, the next issue we visit World War II, what happened there. And that would have been, like you said, a whole 22 pages.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's nice to get a little bit more of some of the scenes and stuff like that. Sometimes it's like, yeah, you didn't really have enough to fill the issue.
Yeah. Sometimes you feel gypped, and sometimes, yeah, it works both ways.
We do a quick scene back at the Tuning Fork in Anthro's time before bouncing to Texas in 1879. Well, get the Old West characters.
I do want to point out that scene back with Commandy.
Mm-hmm.
Do we witness both the introduction here in the first issue and the death of Blue Beetle a couple issues later? The monitor kind of says, I was hoping his scarab would aid me, but it didn't. Oh well. And kind of skips over it from there.
He doesn't die, but I don't know that they really do too much of an explanation. I don't know if we see him again in this series.
Yeah, it's weird the way the monitor, he's fallen off the thing. Eh, that wasn't the case. I'll return him to another time. I'm not sure what's happening there.
They're basically saying, we're done with him in this part, so we're excusing him from the story, as they're about to do with Solovar, yeah. The other wounded one.
Yep.
But the next time I know that we see Blue Beetle is in his own title, After Crisis in the Rebooted World.
Yep.
So I don't know if we see him, I don't remember if we see him later in the series or not. But at the very least, being teleported out of there is probably better than just going splat after falling off the tower.
Fair enough.
So I don't think he's complaining.
No splat.
What actually would be hilarious would be to do a story, and they could do it in the blue and gold title they've got going on now, that takes place between the panel we see of him falling, kind of during that panel where Monitor's about to hit the button, and the panel where he's teleporting, where Booster had gone back in time and saved him for a little bit.
That would have been fun.
Has an adventure with that Ted Kord, and then, I don't know, gets upset and brings him back. I don't know.
That could be funny.
So, yeah.
But yeah, then we go to the Old West.
Yeah, when we get to the Old West and stuff, these were a lot of the characters at the time. It's like I may have heard of, but didn't really know.
Yeah, I've heard Jonah Hex, and I've read Western comics, but I didn't read Jonah Hex at all, really.
We got Jonah Hex, we got Scalpunter, we got Batlash, we've got Johnny Thunder, we got Nighthawk, who later becomes an incarnation of Hawkman. There's a couple other characters, like Cinnamon and whatnot, that I would have expected to get pulled in that didn't. But this is not the first time some of these characters have gotten pulled into stories with the heroes and such.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, in Justice League 198 and 199, the Lord of Time sent a couple of Justice Leaguers, I think it was Hal Jordan, Barry Allen Flash, Elongated Man, and Zatanna, back in time to the Old West. They, of course, lose their memories, because, of course, that makes the story more interesting. And they encounter Jonah Hex, Scalpunter, Batlash, and Cinnamon, which is why when Jonah Hex is like, wait a sec, I recognize that uniform, but not on that guy, when he's looking at John Stewart here. That's how come.
Yeah.
So they're playing fair. They had some good continuity and stuff going. Did they need to bring the Western characters into the same narrative universe as you know, Batman, Superman, and the rest? No, but no harm, no foul.
Yeah.
You know, because you can do some stories occasionally where you intermix them, but if you do it all the time, that's not what people are wanting either.
No, if I'm reading a Western or World War II comic, I want to read about that. I don't want to have the Teen Titans pop in or Superman fly by.
Okay, what would your feelings be if they took this Jonah Hex and dropped him in a dystopic future?
Yeah, also not probably not very good, but I'm sure they did it, didn't they?
18-issue Hex series.
Was it good?
It was interesting, and there was two issues of it that had a kind of a Batman of that era.
Oh, okay.
And then they tried to drop him into actual Gotham City early in the Batman run of the New 52.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they honestly, at Marvel, they're kind of doing something like that with they have Conan running around the Marvel Universe right now. And
Conan, Red Wolf, they've had a few others they've bounced through time like that.
Yeah, it always ends up, it's quirky, it's funny, but then you get tired of it after a while. You're like, all right, let's move on.
I think you can make it work, but you really got to commit to it, and you got to be careful which character you pick. It's more likely for it to go wrong than for it to go right.
Yeah. Yeah, correct.
And again, I couldn't figure out why they brought this particular group of Simon, Cyborg, the John Stewart, Green Lantern, and Firebrand to this period of time.
Yeah, it makes no sense. But, oh well, we went with it.
If we'd gotten Simon, who maybe had somehow amped up, you know, John Stewart's power ring or something like that, maybe it would have been cool, but they didn't go there.
It's just, it seems like completely randomness at this point.
Yeah. So, again, whenever a story says a character's got a plan, it's like, yeah, usually they don't. Also, at this point, when John Stewart's power ring has like a half day's charge, but no juice, I don't know what was going on with that.
Me neither. I saw that and I didn't know why, because he literally is holding his hand out and then the look of shock. Nothing's happening.
Well, when did we see Oa? Was that in the last issue?
Yes, but there's two answers to that, of when did we see it in terms of which issue, and then also when did we see it as to what time frame was Oa in when we saw it? Because I took that to be then present day, because they didn't specify otherwise, and that's where something happens to the Guardians. It doesn't look like the battery explodes.
But clearly something is going on with the battery, so maybe that's what they're trying to imply with Stewart's ring?
Possibly.
Yeah, but my understanding of how the thing worked is that would have prevented his lantern from getting, you know, charged, because it was kind of the remote outlet, if you will, for the thing. But the ring holds a 24-hour charge, and it had half that left. So it shouldn't just suddenly go dry.
Yeah.
But there was a lot going on in the Green Lantern title at this point. Hal was not a Green Lantern. This is why we've got John Stewart. Guy Gardner really becomes a Green Lantern, although he'd been one intermittently before then. We wind up, within a couple issues later, with the Green Lantern Corps being a contingent of them based on Earth. So it was definitely a period of big change for that title. I also couldn't tell quite what happened with Simon above that panel with John.
Yeah.
With all the red.
Yep. Yeah.
He gets hit by one of the shadow demons, and I don't know.
Well, yeah.
Generally what happens here, then they're like, oh my goodness, the cave's collapsing. And the next thing you know, Nighthawk is outside by himself riding away and gets caught by the antimatter wave. And so I have no idea what happened to anyone else that was in that cave at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no clue.
The implication is that I don't think Nighthawk made it all that far.
I tend to agree.
So that wave's not all that far away. And I thought we saw... Maybe, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they all got wiped out right then.
I haven't read the other issues lately, so I don't know.
But I think the ones that were sent by the Monitor, I do think continue to show up later, possibly.
I would...
Yeah. Nobody knows.
I would think so. If so, it would be Cyborg, John Stewart, and Firebrand. I don't think we see much of Simon. We'll have when we get to where we've reread the others.
We'll get there, yep.
Or maybe we won't. Because there's enough going on, they may not come back to some of these characters. Because, spoiler, this whole thing's a big reset switch for the DC Universe.
Spoiler alert.
When they say worlds will live, worlds will die, they were not kidding. Page 24 here, we get the Legion of Superheroes. Really kind of a subtle thing that I think a lot of people may not get. this really shows how this was an all-hands-on-deck kind of a situation for the Legion when we see Kid Psycho out in the field. Kid Psycho, who's hit there by the antimatter wave, he was a Legion reservist, and the reason he was a reservist was his unfortunate aspect of his psychokinetic powers. They shorten his life with every use.
Oh.
So they only use him in the most dire of circumstances, and I think, you know, reality getting wiped out kind of counts.
Yeah, that's right there.
So, but again, love the Legion, so always nice to see them, even if it doesn't go too well for them.
Yeah, and then the monitor gets the big surprise at the end.
Kind of, sort of, they kind of backpedal on this a little. It seems like she's there in the room from the way this is done, particularly the wrong old fool in that second to last panel.
Yeah.
But based on next issue, it seems like she wasn't in the room.
Correct. This is, if you're reading this, you're like, what the heck? But yeah, correct. She's not there.
But, I mean, they'd already set up. She was going to kill him. He knew it. She may not have figured it out yet, but
it's going to happen.
All right, moving on to that fourth issue. Love how we spend a little bit of time with Supergirl and Batgirl chatting and stuff. Nice, just fun character moment.
Yeah, I like that.
And it's funny because those two obviously knew each other, but it's not like they hung out all the time. Man, what a missed opportunity for what would have been a great series at that point.
I would have read it. I would have liked it.
Yeah. Now, we get a really short kind of a scene here with Steve Dayton, who is a supporting cast member at this point of the New Teen Titans. He is the kind of adopted father of Changeling. He was also Mento of the Doom Patrol. And he's hanging with an old friend of his, John Constantine.
Oh, yeah.
Now, at this point, Constantine was just part of the supporting cast for Swamp Thing.
That's it.
This is before the whole Hellblazer series.
Oh, okay.
300 issues.
So he's just a guy.
I wouldn't say he's just a guy. He's still John Constantine, but he's not really the one we kind of know and think of today.
Okay.
And I really don't recall those two kind of knowing each other before, but I'm not going to say they didn't. Because I'm honestly not all that well-versed on that era of Swamp Thing. It's, again, one of the characters I didn't kind of gravitate towards. I got on afterwards, particularly as it was tying in with all this, because it played quite a bit on the whole mystical side of things. But yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. And again, that's just a little bit of, you know, bottom of one page, top of another, and then we move on.
Yeah.
Go over to Earth 6, and this is a world that was new, not just to DC, but entirely at this point.
Oh, wow.
So if you don't know who any of these characters are, nobody did.
For a reason. Like the guy with the Shazam logo on his forehead. All right.
Yeah, Lord Vault. We got him, we got his wife, Lady Quark, their daughter, Liana, who I think goes by Princess Fern at some point. And again, this is essentially a token world to kill off.
Yeah. They literally just created it just to destroy.
Well, Lady Quark's pretty important.
Lady Quark serves as a plot device.
Fair enough.
It's not like she became something after this. If they had turned her into, I was going to say an ongoing character, but hell, even a recurring character. Yeah. Again, they had to show that Pariah, who's bouncing from world to world to watch what's going wrong go wrong, could save somebody. Yep. This is a series or a world that I think would have benefited if they had done like a one-shot or something leading into it to set these characters up. They couldn't have done it at the time because, again, one-shots and whatnot just really didn't happen that much. If they had done it as if it were a new ongoing series, introduce them, oh, crisis is happening, we see all this, and yep, that's the end of their title. That could have been funny.
Yeah.
Could have been aggravating, but it could have been funny.
I'm laughing thinking about it.
And then we get the monitor essentially instigating the origin of the new Dr. Light.
Yes.
And I gotta say, the introduction of her, she's not a very nice person.
No, she's not.
So, and of course, at this point, the Dr. Light that was known was the villain of the Fearsome Five, of the Teen Titans.
How many Dr. Lights have there been?
I want to say three, but I'm blanking on what the third would have been.
Well, isn't the third one the one that the killer in the crisis, or the one that at least had his brain wiped that started that whole crisis?
No, that Dr. Light, Arthur Light, that started Identity yes. Crisis, the instigating, he was the previous one.
Okay, so he came back.
So I think there's just the two. Oh, yeah, he never really went away. She just kind of usurped his identity and, I guess, stole his costume, whether or not literally it's the same design. Yeah. again, it was a character that was a bit of a laughing stock, so, you know, why not try to reuse the name, as was frequent in this time period. Because so many characters were white guys, let's even up the racial mix and representation. In this case, a Japanese woman. In other cases, when they were replacing characters, they would do the same sort of a thing. We got a Hispanic Wildcat, a black female Dr. Midnight, and a few other things like that. And I got mixed feelings when they're taking an established identity, handing it off kind of sort of as if it's a legacy and stuff. I mean, if you're doing that, you've certainly got the opportunity to widen the field of representation. And I do think that's a good thing. But there is a point where there's still derivative characters.
It's not a new character.
No, it's not. Well, the dividing line on that is really, how do you determine what's a new character or not? She, of Dr. Kamiyo Hoshi or whatever, is arguably a new character, but Dr. Light, even of female version, is a derivative character. So I found it very interesting, if you look at the opening credits of the Stargirl series, the characters of Stargirl is not referred to as Stargirl, but as whatever her character name is that I'm blanking on at the moment, her civilian name, and that's credited to Jeff Johns.
Ah, okay.
Because the Stargirl persona is clearly derivative of a couple of different characters. So some of it is just, you know, how do you slice it, and then who gets credit for what and who gets paid for what. So I don't know if there's anything important that this thing is coming from the star of Vega, which is, I think, the realm that Starfire's planet is in and all of that thing. But we get kind of a vague, I don't know if it's, I guess, an explosion and she vanishes and now she's going to become Dr. Light. A lot of that was just kind of wavy hands, but we get a new character, so hey, that's cool.
Yeah.
And we get a little bit here with Red Tornado, but we're seeing him kind of from afar. And it's interesting because they mention he's like one of the most powerful Justice Leaguers.
Is he?
Well, it's true, but not necessarily as Red Tornado. Red Tornado is not just kind of an android. It's easy to think of him as kind of an analog to the Vision.
Okay.
The thing is, he's got an air elemental, the Tornado Tyrant or Tornado Champion or both, kind of trapped inside of him, which is why he's got the powers.
Okay.
So you let that thing loose, definitely you've now got, you know, an elemental kind of a thing flying around.
All right, cool.
But I love this version of Red Tornado and such, and this is really kind of the last we see of him for, I'm going to say, decades. I mean, we really haven't, we saw him a little bit in Young Justice, but it was a more kind of robotic version than this one who was, I don't say becoming human, but metaphorically, you know, that way. If I mean, not literally. Anyways, fun character. I am curious if his design had any influence on Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Yeah.
Particularly the arrow there on the head.
Yeah, I could see that.
But then we bounce to Earth 2, the time of Arthur, so I'm going to just call this area Camelot, for lack of a better term. And it's interesting, because we get a couple of the quote-unquote locals, Shining Knight, Vandal Savage, and again, it's just showing how diverse the settings and such in the DC Universe are.
It's insane. It went everywhere. Everywhere. So, yeah, they sucked in every time frame, timeline, every nook and cranny of the DC Universe.
Well, and it's interesting, if you look there on 12, page 12, where we see Vandal Savage, the way he's depicted these days, they take the Savage part a little more literally.
Oh, yeah. Much.
This guy seems a lot more aristocratic.
Yeah. He almost looks like Tony Stark standing there.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a medieval Tony Stark kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought this was all kind of fun. When we get there with the shadow demons kind of merging into whatever they merge into, okay, that was kind of interesting. And this is one of those times where we're actually starting to cut between all the different scenes of the various locations with the tuning forks of, you know, the Great Disaster, Atlantis, Makovia, Texas, and in this area of kind of Camelot or whatever.
Everywhere.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that, you know, I knew what was going on. I was able to follow it and stuff, but I could definitely see where, you know, if you're thinking you got to know who everyone is in each one of those panels, it could be a little overwhelming.
Oh, yeah. It was a lot, but yeah. But basically, we're revisiting all those things.
Mm-hmm. But then this sixth one shows up in modern New York City. And it's kind of funny, because the new Dr. Light, in a costume that's very much like the original Dr. Light's, is sitting there shouting in Japanese. And of course, you know, people don't know Japanese for the most part. They don't know she's trying to protect the thing because it can save the planet. Although Superman quickly, you know, realizes that. I just thought that was just kind of funny. It's particularly since Starfire and Halo, who have light sort of based powers, were coming at her. It's like, oh, are they going to power her up? Is she going to use their powers or whatnot? Flip side, you know, Starfire can learn languages by skin contact, so she had the opportunity to learn Japanese. Just saying. But yeah, we get some fun stuff. And again, I like this version of the Outsiders, and of course, love the Titans, so fun seeing them.
Yeah.
I wonder what happened to Garth in here. I find it interesting, around page 15, in the top panel, I'm assuming that's Garth as the owl.
The bird or whatever, yeah, yeah.
But
maybe it's an owl.
Yeah, whatever. But by the time you get to the two of them continuing on, he's no longer anywhere to be seen.
He catches Halo.
Does he?
Yeah, you get the top page where they get blasted back.
Oh, got it. You're right, that is him. Never mind. I'm trying to figure out why he wasn't as close as they were. What held him back?
They fly faster than that.
Fair enough.
That's all I got. I did find it funny how Katana had to point out, hey, I speak Japanese. Yes. She's not our enemy.
That was funny.
Now, I'll admit, I got a little lost on what was going on around the end of page 16 and start of 17 when we go to Paradise Island, in so much as I couldn't remember what the current status quo was for Wonder Woman, why she was trying to make peace with her mother and why that didn't happen and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't really matter too much to the story, but without that, I'm like, okay, what's really going on in the scene and why do I care?
Yeah, I didn't know. It's just in there, but I didn't know what's going on or why it's there.
Yeah, yeah. And then we get Pariah meeting Monitor and a little bit of kind of exposition and whatnot there, although cryptic. And Monitor allowed Pariah to live. Not entirely sure why and stuff. And I do like that two-page where we get, you know, just the various scenes of what's going on and just some quick cameos by characters like, I mean, we see actually at that point most of the characters in the Old West getting out of that cave successfully.
Yep.
We see Lori Lamaris and Dolphin, so some underwater stuff going on there. We see Blue Devil, the Hawks, Airwave, who doesn't get seen. I don't know if he'd been seen after this. Zatanna and such. And just a couple other characters here and there. And it's just, there's so much going on that getting just a quick shot of some of the JSA and Infinity Inc. characters, it's fun. If you know who they are, you know who they are. If you don't,
it's still kind of cool.
There are people trying to save the day. That's all you need to know.
Exactly.
So, definitely fun stuff. And just so much to read here, both in terms of words on the page and also just what's going on.
There's so much depth here. It's a lot to absorb.
Yeah. And then it's funny because we get to the point where we've been told Harbinger is going to go kill the Monitor. So, you know, that finally happens. She's kind of flipping out while she's doing it because she's obviously being controlled by the Other, which we'll learn is the Anti-Monitor and such.
Yep.
But Pariah is there the whole time and he's like not knowing what to do. I'm like, geez, you've been to catastrophe after catastrophe. I get PTSD. I get you're a little overloaded, but useless.
He just stood there and watched.
But that's Pariah. He is useless. He sits there and watches. That's kind of what
we
see.
He sits there, he cries, he weeps, yeah. And he bellyaches.
He saves Lady Quark for some reason, but no one else.
He was, as you can imagine, not a particularly popular character at the time, as I recall.
Well, yeah, not someone I'd want to read.
I think you could do a series with him. It would be tough. And he'd have to actually do a little more than just show up somewhere and bemoan, oh, you're going to die too, and then be upset by it.
He was just your omniscient narrator. Talk about a character that's purely a plot device. This is comics, and before we had the narration boxes, I know, we'll just have a guy pop up to be our omniscient narrator.
Yeah, and show the emotion that we're supposed to feel.
Exactly.
Weeping and crying, and so we're weeping and crying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you got to admit, when this is ending on Earth 1 and Earth 2, getting destroyed by the antimatter wave, and they've flat out said worlds will live, worlds will die, and they haven't been bluffing so far. Hell of a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
That was a really big cliffhanger.
As far as it looks like, I mean, this could be the end of the series. I guess you got Alexander and Harbinger on the satellite, and other than that, there's nothing in the universe. Oh, well, the Other. and the Psycho Pirate.
Well, we don't know if he's in this universe or not.
Okay. The other exists, Psycho Pirate exists, and like I said, I think Harbinger and Alexander Luther on the satellite. And as far as we can tell, that's the only thing left.
Do we actually see the satellite surviving?
Well...
Or is there reason to think it was taken along with the Earth?
There's no reason to think it's in the same place as the Earth, because it hasn't been
fair
to
enough,
this
fair
point.
Enough.
But yeah, that's fair too.
We don't know where it is, so its status is legitimately
exactly.
Known. Yeah. And again, reading this month to month at the time, and it's having ramifications, because this was not just its own standalone title. As Sam was mentioning, there were dozens of things tying into this. You know, you had a Teen Titans issue where they're in New York dealing with this stuff that's going on at the antimatter wave. Same kind of similar things with the Legion, with other titles. This was, you know, a you could not avoid kind of event if you were reading DC Comics.
And I don't think anywhere, as I'm looking at these covers and stuff, I don't think anywhere is on these original covers, they just have a number, month, and year. You didn't know necessarily how many there were going to be, did you?
I think they had said it was going to be a 12-issue okay. series, but I'm not 100% positive.
The first issue just says spectacular first issue, and all the rest of them just have a number. So when you get to the end of this, you have no idea what you might be walking in to pick up at the comic shop next week.
Well, and certainly they could spend the next 8 issues establishing a new status quo. You know, this was literally anything could happen at this point. It was, you know, they'd already, again, in these issues, killed off the crime syndicate, a bunch of their World War II characters, a few of their Western characters. It looked like, at this point, all of Earth 1, Earth 2. It was definitely a take-no-prisoners kind of attitude here.
So last question on this from me. Were you feeling excitement or anxiety when you read this issue? Can you remember?
Excitement.
Excitement. Okay, cool.
It was one of those things that, certainly there was no jadedness that I've got today.
Okay.
If I were reading, if this were a modern comic and I was reading this, I'm like, dude, you overplayed your hand.
You're going to have to walk this back now.
You know, I see Superman there. He's going to live. Both of them are going to live, you know? But at this point where there was very much a, and they say it in the story, we have a multiverse. It's supposed to be a universe. Things are going to be different. You know, and you know coming out of this, we're going to wind up with a Superman, a Batman, the money makers.
Yeah, correct.
But you really don't know what their status quo is going to be. You don't know, you know, anything of that. And there were people, some name creators now, name even at the time, that after this, it was not their Superman. It was not their Batman because maybe got thrown out with the bathwater in their mind.
Ah, interesting.
And I don't think they were necessarily wrong. Now, at this point, I was a teenager. I'd been reading comics, you know, 5-plus years or whatever. I knew a lot of these characters, but it was still learning new characters, exploring new worlds, all that kind of a thing. So having a bit of a blank slate and coming in at the ground floor, that was exciting.
I can imagine. I imagine, you know, how old were you? Like 15? I don't know.
Thereabouts.
Yeah, you're like, okay, this is cool. What is coming? You're excited.
Well, yeah. Now, I've seen them, I've seen the reality after this play out and get destroyed a few times.
And you're thinking 6 or 7 years down the road, it'll be back to the way it was. That's today.
I'm feeling it's a pendulum that swings back and forth, and they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, which is very true.
And they did not come out of this with a clean game plan, either. I'll be upfront on that. They tried, and made a good intent, but this arguably made a huge mess of things afterwards.
And I would argue, though, in some ways it worked. At least after this, this is the DC Universe I fell in love with, was the one that came just after this.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, having gone back and read this, I was excited, like James was just saying, to see where this was going.
Mm-hmm.
The next time I can remember DC really doing this, not some of the intervening crises, but really, hey, we're starting over, was Flashpoint. And at that point, I remember, I didn't even read Flashpoint. I just kind of stopped reading for 6 months going, okay, this stuff's all lame duck. It doesn't matter. I'll see what happens when the new 52 starts.
There was no feeling of lame duckness going into this because there was no precedent for this and all the titles fed into this.
Yeah, well, same thing with Flashpoint, sort of.
No, Flashpoint, there was definitely a feeling of lame duckness for all the titles.
Well, you're right, because the Flashpoint titles were all separate miniseries, and the ongoings literally just ended with no conclusion. That's right. I forgot about that.
Well, some of them concluded.
Yeah, that's true.
But it was in a, are we ever going to see these characters again, and will it matter?
That's true.
Because there was very much a, we're going to be doing a relaunch of the entire universe and such. So having an event that doesn't put your existing titles, characters, and franchises into that lame duck status, you know, that makes a big difference. And again, it's something that they had a cohesive, if not perfect, continuity going into this. And coming out of it, there are a couple of times, oh, we get a few different origins for Hawkman or the Green Lantern Corps or something like that. Okay, a few stumbles, that happens. But having gone through Zero Hour, 52, Infinite Crisis, Final Crisis, you know, the Blackest Night or Darkest Night's
death metal
stuff. You know, they've retooled their universe a few too many times, and they've gone back and retold origins a few too many times. I mean, as funny as it is that they were on the DC Universe app apparently referencing the wrong Teen Titans number 13 or whatever, if somebody said, you know, you should go read the issue where Supergirl, you know, crashes to Earth for the first time, there's like five or six different versions of that story to read. And that's just insane.
That is kind of insane. Which decade do you want to read?
that is interesting. No, it's just weird hearing you say that. I can't imagine that being a question, but I guess it is.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got the original, what was it, Action Comics 252 or whatever.
Yeah, 252, that's the answer as far as I would be concerned, but I guess maybe it's not.
Well, it's then you've got the post-crisis version where she crashes to Earth. There's a new 52 version or two where she crashes to, or comes to Earth for the first time. One where it was, I guess, maybe after, I forget if it was after Zero, when it was, where she came to Earth and was sent to Paradise Island, or Themyscira, or whatever they were calling it at that time. It's like, you know, who were the founding members of the Justice League or the Titans or whatever, and it comes down to which incarnation and which universe did you start on? And that's where I think the unraveling of the continuity becomes problematic.
Yeah, and again, I guess it has to do with your age or how much you care about him. I mean, again, Justice League. The answer is Brave and the Bold 28. It doesn't seem to matter, but I guess there are fans that don't see it that way.
Well, there are going to be ones who came in with Justice League number one after, you know, with the new 52. That's the origin of the universe, or the Justice League, as far as they're concerned.
Or even the Justice League number one from After Crisis, I guess. The one Batman was in for like three issues and then left.
Yeah, the Giffen de Mateus era. And you wind up with a very different feel of what's the Justice League supposed to be at that point.
Very true. Yeah, I look at it and I try to just think of a book like Fantastic Four. Although they may reference the origin, you don't see it being retold over and over and over again. I haven't seen it like four or five times.
They've retold the origin of the Fantastic Four a few times in miniseries and flashbacks or whatever.
But it's identical.
They may tweak which war it was or when it was.
Correct.
Window dressing. But to your point, it's functionally the same story. It's the same four members.
Correct.
You know, unless you're talking about, like, the alternate universe, which is a divergent universe, and stuff like that. But that's where I think DC, and for the longest time, they'd done all right, but then it got to the point where they've rejiggered and retconned their backstory so many times that it, I don't want to say it's irrevocably damaged, but it's certainly frayed at the edges pretty seriously.
Yeah. Even the new 52 Superman, he just kind of disappeared, you know? They got rid of him.
Well, they killed him off, replaced him. That was a big deal for a while until suddenly it wasn't.
Yeah, just gone. Never to be seen again.
You know? So there is an aspect of me that, as I'm reading this, it's, this is the era of comics I grew up really loving, and I still love it, and I still resonate with these characters in a way that I just kind of don't with modern characters. If this were a modern story, do you think we would have spent about half an issue with various people like the Titans and the Outsiders saving civilians?
No.
It just doesn't happen.
Nope.
And that's why I don't resonate with the current superheroes as much as these heroic heroes.
Yeah, the civilians just would have been, like you said, just props in the background.
Well, and John, I think as you have said before, when's the last time a superhero stopped a bank robbery?
Yeah.
Usually.
Now, if it was because villains were smart enough not to do bank robberies anymore, okay, maybe. But that's certainly not it. I mean, it used to be Spider-Man would be stopping muggings left, right, and center.
He doesn't do that anymore.
These days, nobody does.
Yep. Daredevil doesn't do it. Nobody does it.
Yeah. I mean, the last time I think I saw like a mugging or a pickpocketing, it was because the hero was getting his wallet taken.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I know the comic you're talking about, too.
Uh-huh. So, I really enjoyed this. Like I said, I love this era of DC. I feel this is, like, the most epic of epic storylines in comics. If you are a DC fan, even a later fan than this era, and you've never read Crisis, I think you should. But again, go in knowing it is a huge epic story. You're not going to know all these characters. You don't need to.
Yeah.
If you want to learn more about them and do a little research, there's Wikipedia, there's Who's Who in the DC Universe. There's a ton of pre-Crisis comics to go read, some of which are excellent.
Yeah, and these 12 issues are going to read like 30 issues.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that this kind of story can be told again, or be told today.
Yeah, I don't think so.
You say that, John, and you were thinking about it? Or maybe Flashpoint, I didn't have the same feel, at least for me. Do you remember the end of Infinite Crisis and the 1 year later in 52? That was super exciting, at least for me as a DC fan. And I did have that feeling of, hey, anything can happen and it's kind of all new. And
I would say Infinite Crisis is the closest they've ever come to replicating the excitement of this. But there's a certain aspect of repaving a repaved road, I guess. And it wasn't doing the tour of the DC Universe times, places, and worlds and stuff that this is doing.
No.
And it didn't have the density of story. Well, it was an awesome read. Don't get me wrong. I love that and would be willing to do that as some back issue spotlights at some point. And it'd be a good follow-on to this one. This one just covered so much more ground.
Yeah, that is true.
And that was a response to this, and I don't know that I feel that the changes that came out of Infinite Crisis were of the magnitude of the changes that came out of Crisis on Infinite Earths. I say that, and I will fess up that I would be hard-pressed at the moment to name any particular change out of Infinite Crisis that stuck. Not that there weren't any, it's just been long enough since I've read it, I've forgotten what they would be.
Theoretically, we got a multiverse back.
Yeah, but we'd kind of already, well.
Theoretically, that's why I said theoretically.
I was going to say, to me, that was more out of 52.
Yeah.
And I'm having to place which event happened when.
Well,
first.
52, because if you remember, when Infinite Crisis ended, we skipped the year, and it was 1 year later, and 52 then filled in that year weekly. So 52 literally was the next thing after Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, but I think I'd have to reread Crisis. I was going to say, I thought Infinite Crisis got us back down to a universe. And the tail end of 52 blew it back out to the multiverse.
Okay, I think of them as kind of the same event, but sure, fair enough.
I don't, but they're certainly tied at the hip. Yeah, again, this is some fun stuff. This is only the first third of it.
Yeah.
Like I said, if you haven't read it, Wolfman and Perez, I think, at pretty much the top of their game.
Yep.
Doing just some epic stuff. It's just incredible.
I agree.
So we'll come back for issues 5 through 8. I think 7 is another double-sized issue, so again, quite a bit to read for that. And then after that, we'll do another one doing the final 4 issues and such.
Cool.
Anything else? Are we done?
That does it for me.
I'm good.
I had fun.
Cool. Yeah, definitely fun. The October previews came out on September 29th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 167 is the morning of Saturday, October 9th. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The show notes and form for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.